On this edition of Nurturing Wellbeing with Kurt Kelly, I have the opportunity to interview two ladies that came to our conference. They have been doing breakout sessions with our folks, and I'm going to be interviewing Brittany Garrett and Charlotte Tarsi of PARI. Now, PARI stands for Police Assisted Addiction and Recovery Initiative. I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. Two lovely ladies who have really committed themselves to helping change communities. And with that, I hope you enjoy Nurturing Wellbeing with Kurt Kelly. Welcome, Charlotte, Brittany. We're so glad that you're here today. We're going to be talking about PARI. And I want you to give a lot more explanation about it, how it came about, and what's your engagement with it. We'll start with you, Brittany.
Sure, absolutely. So PARI is the Police Assisted Addiction and Recovery Initiative. Long title. We'll just call it PARI from here on out. But so we're a nonprofit. We were founded in 2015. We were founded along the original Gloucester Angel Initiative, which was a police-led program from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Really what was happening in the community, they're a small fishing community, and they were seeing a lot of overdoses, as many communities were in 2015. They were seeing this in their community, and they were like, we have to do something differently. Kind of had a town hall, started talking about, you know, ideas and suggestions. And the chief of police at the time just went to Facebook and he said, you know, starting next month, anybody who has drugs, drug paraphernalia, needs help, they can come into our police station. We're not going to charge you with a crime, and we're going to find a place for you to get help. And which was really just revolutionary and just different from how police were really approaching this issue.
It was a crime before. It's still a crime, but we want you to come in. We're going to work on help you get past this.
Absolutely. And really the post went viral. Hundreds of thousands of people saw it. And they just opened their doors. They had, you know, they just figured it out. They figured out ways to create pathways in the community that didn't exist before. They started working with local treatment, people with lived experience, volunteers to help with the program. And they just got started. And so they quickly realized that a lot of people wanted to know about this and wanted to replicate this, and also had maybe a lot of other organizations that were doing similar programs. So they were quickly overwhelmed with calls. How do we do this? So we were formed as a nonprofit along with our co-founder, John Rosenthal. They founded this nonprofit to support the original initiative, but also any other departments, police departments that wanted to be across this movement to destigmatize, to help people struggling with addiction. And that's where it started. That's where it was born. And I was a police officer in Kentucky at the time. Around that time, I just became sergeant in my police department. We were saying the same things. And I just remember being like, I feel like we could be doing something differently, and kind of challenging the way that I was brought up through the system and how I learned to deal with people in the community that were struggling with substance use. And I found this article and I was like, wow, I think we could do this here. And, you know, got, you know, support from my chief, from my mayor. It took some time. It wasn't easy, but we got that support and we launched the first type of that program in the state of Kentucky. And from there, you know, that just changed the trajectory of my career. I'm lucky enough now to be staffed with PARI as their director of public safety training and outreach to speak this, you know, this language and what we're doing across the country to these. We have hundreds of police departments. We're over 650 police.
So is it housed in, it's housed inside like police and not behavioral health, although I think kind of a combo.
Yeah. And Charlotte will talk about that like quite a bit. Like a lot of times in these areas, it was police led initially because they're like, we cannot keep doing the same stuff. We can't keep responding to people dying. We can't keep throwing people in jail or taking them to the ER to be back in the city before we get back there. We know this isn't working. So a lot of areas it was police led, but it's always with collaboration with public health and behavioral health. It's always with, you know, thinking about the schools, the child welfare agencies, you know, any ways that we can change and break down these silos. It may be led by behavioral health or police at first, but it's always with collaboration.
Yeah. And in the meantime, while that was happening with Brittany, I was in Massachusetts in Plymouth County. And I remember seeing the articles about the Gloucester Angel Initiative and being just so excited that this was happening in my state. I knew as a clinic director at a behavioral health organization that provided dual diagnosis, substance use and mental health treatment to individuals who needed that, that there was a real need for a different way of approaching things. In Plymouth County, I was fortunate enough to be also connected with the police departments. I became involved with the Plymouth County Hub, which is a grant funded program overseen by PARI. And first I was collaborating as the clinic director. And then when the opportunity arose, I took on the program manager position. And that's where I come into PARI.
I can imagine in the early days, and you are sort of mentioning to it, but it's sort of in the early days, we see the side that says, yes, it's a behavioral health issue. And yes, we come in with all of our experiences from our training and counseling and so forth. Law enforcement's over here going, wait a second, hold on, this is a criminal behavior, a criminal act. There had to probably be some dynamic tension initially. But then you started mentioning to us that you saw the successes. What were some of the successes that began to change even the mindset of the law enforcement?
Yeah, I think especially from, you know, most law enforcement, especially when we go back 10, 20, 30, 40 years, however long we go, that, you know, it's literally this idea of like, okay, you see someone commit a crime, arrest them for the crime, take them to jail, repeat that process until the end of time. Take them to the hospital if they don't really go to the jail. You know, there's like none of these outroads, inroads to getting people into the connection to care that might be more beneficial to them than traditional processes like the criminal justice system or high utilizing emergency care. We know that it costs more than anything that exists out there that we could possibly provide resources to. We know that it's oftentimes causes serious ramifications on families when people are incarcerated or pulled from their homes or all of these other things. Things that like I didn't think about at the beginning of my career, and a lot of law enforcement officers don't. And so really it was about educating each other. It was having this open mind to go, okay, maybe I haven't done everything the right. Maybe I need to adjust my frame of mind about what I'm doing in the community and a way of helping in a philosophy that I hadn't thought about. And really that's the opening that I had and a lot of officers started having. But the vast majority of communities in the beginning had open arms from public health and behavioral health. I know when I went to my communities and I started knocking on treatment centers' doors, I was like, hi, I'm a police officer, and we've got this program that we want to help people get into drug treatment, right? You would think that, you know, but I'm telling you, it was door after door opened. And there were a few that closed and never really reopened. But for the most part, it was, what, you want to do this? You want to help people get into treatment instead of taking them to jail when they're, you know, in suffering from this? I'm like, yes, that's what we want to do. I don't know how to do that because I'm a cop. I need to learn how to do that. I need to know who I need at the table. And door after door opened for us. I know in Plymouth and some of these other areas, there are always roadblocks because everyone's in their silos. When you operate a certain way for so long, it's hard for somebody from the outside going, hey, can we change this? But we have to take a step back and maybe put our own, you know, sort of mindset of how we think this thing's supposed to work aside. And I think a lot of work gets done in those tensions, in those uncomfortable parts, because there were plenty of rooms that I walked in and they did not want a police officer there. Or there are rooms that I walked in and police didn't want public health or behavioral health or somebody with lived experience there. And you have to just clear the air. And what we started to see, we had an early training that we did that was a collaboration with our local treatment center. And they came in, they had a peer, it was a modification on like stigma training, peer support training. And they came in and they brought people who were in their peer support program. They'd been in treatment for about 6 to 9 months. And they came in and just had conversations with our police officers and our civilian staff. And you just saw this like wall drop down.
Wow.
Because we don't, as law enforcement, we don't see people in recovery. Nobody calls the police department to say, hey, everything's fine.
Yeah, good job. Appreciate you getting us out of that situation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Even the arrest.
Yeah.
Appreciate you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not often rare in your career you run across somebody and they say, thank you for arresting me. Sometimes it does happen. But when we started to hear people can get into recovery because we see the same people overdosing. We see the same people being victimized or committing crimes. We think that that's the only way that it can happen. And you do that for 20 or 25 years. What's your view of people who are struggling with addiction or mental illness? But when we had this level playing field and people in recovery could talk to police officers in a safe environment, because most of them had very negative interactions with law enforcement because they were either fighting with law enforcement, they were going to jail. So you just saw this like calming effect and buy-in that was happening on both ends, because the people in the recovery community, the people who are still in active addiction, have to trust that the police department is doing what we say we're going to do. that we, when I say I'm going to help you and get you connected to treatment, there are very small circumstances in which I can't do that. Like if you have a violent warrant or you've got some other things going on or a violent crime happens, there are certain things I got to still navigate in the systems. However, I want to help you in any way that I can. And we had to do that work and build that buy-in with the community. And then the officer seeing people get into recovery. When you have somebody come up and go, hey, do you remember that person we brought in last week? How are they doing? And we're like, well, actually, they just got connected to an outpatient resource. They're doing okay. And the officers are going, wow, I, you know, other than taking someone to jail, like I never know what happens to anybody. We just wait for that another call for service. So 3 months later, they're going, you know, we haven't gotten a call back to that address that we kept getting a call back every other day. And I was like, yeah, because they got resources that they needed.
Sounds like a social services, behavioral health, mental health experts dream. That they would be able to say, okay, we've got folks that are out here dealing with the crisis involved and in some cases exacerbating the long-term problems. And we're coming up and says, let's talk about, Charlotte, you got to tell me about solutions. Some of the things that have taken place and as PARI exists, how have, I was a former legislator. What I would say is, you know, show me how this is impacting and frankly, in some respects, the bottom line, less people going to jail, less people going in long-term, less violent crimes. There's got to be that kind of data. Talk to me a little bit about how do we see some of those things besides the transformation of the lives that you've dealt.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things to think about, and again, speaking about the county that I live in, Plymouth County Outreach is an outreach program that does post-overdose follow-ups. So they have built a system where all 27 municipal police departments are working together. When there is an overdose, the police check off a box in a system, and that individual is now sent over to PCO. PCO schedules a visit.
PCO?
Plymouth County Outreach.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yep.
Okay, yeah.
They schedule a visit with a peer recovery coach and a plainclothed police officer to go out and do a door knock within 48 hours. So that door knock is an invitation to learn about the services that they could access because they have a concern that's related to substance use. So how do you want services? Here's the services that are available. Do you want to get into detox today? We'll get you in there. Do you want a referral to behavioral health? We'll get you in there right now today. So that has resulted in a decrease in overdose deaths in the Plymouth County. So for multiple years. And that to me is, we want to save lives. These are individuals who are struggling with a brain related addiction, and they need support to get them the help that they need to stabilize their lives and be able to move on. And many of these initiatives are led by people who are in recovery themselves. So they understand what it's like to have been there and to have had people give up on them and have people want to save their lives. And that is just a huge thing. And then when you add on to that, the Plymouth County Hub situation table model, which is what I manage, that's an opportunity for individuals to get into connection with a variety of multiple service sectors. Police departments can bring up an individual that they've been to the home multiple times and maybe they haven't overdosed yet. They don't need to go to the hospital for suicidal ideation. They don't need to go to the hospital for a detox yet. And they're not going to be arrested today, but we've been to the home 3 times this month. There's something going on and we don't know where to turn here. So they tell us about the different risk factors that an individual or family are experiencing. And in that room is all of the different service sector community providers. And those community providers say, I can help with that. I'll be part of the conversation to help with that. And their role is to then connect with that person within 24 to 48 hours.
Not only professionals that are engaged in this, but you took me right to where I was going to get a question because it's an area that we're working on in child welfare. Mm-hmm. We understand that folks that have lived, so the lived experience element of this, it provides genuine life experience of what's happening and they can speak. There's a genuineness to that you've walked in my shoes and you understand it. The second area is it's, they know when they're being conned and when they're not. And I think that there, and at the end of the day, if we're looking for true healing, true therapy, then you want to have talk. Let's talk about how do you engage those type of individuals in a non-judgmental way?
Well, I think what's critical to kind of what Charlotte has said is engaging people with lived experience at the beginning of when you're thinking about what are these programs, when you identify the problem that's going on in the community, overdoses, domestic violence, whatever the case is that you're identifying that we really need to address this. Involving people with lived experience has across research shown that it's important. The way we started it was starting with as talking to the treatment centers and finding out who's in peer support inside of those treatment centers that would be willing to help us in this program. And then they knew, we were really lucky. We have Young People in Recovery, which is a great organization, national organization. We had a chapter that was local. They were, I mean, just paramount to us getting our program off the ground because they vouched for us. They, you know, we had people thinking, oh, this is a scam. I'm going to go into the police department. They're going to arrest me for blah, 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 blah. And we're like, oh gosh, I never thought people would think it's a scam. Like, we're really trying to help. You know, like, what do we do? And they went on the news and said, no, this is legit. And I'm telling you, we never had another question about it. Never had another question about that because they bring so much credibility to the table that we have to, again, the more you do what you say you're going to do, you build credibility with the communities that oftentimes, you know, we're not on the same page with. Working with your recovery communities, anything that we can do to bridge those gaps is really important. I just know how important it is.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking a little bit more back to the statistics of like, what is the results here? For the Plymouth County Hub, those police-led situations, so we've had police departments bring up individuals in their community that need help. And then we wrap around the services. These are the providers doing the work that they already do in the community, just a little more proactively because this person is likely to be in crisis soon if we don't intervene. And what we've seen is that through a three-month poll, we've seen that those police-led situations, nearly 50% of those situations, the police didn't know where they were at 3 months later. That's success. Police are not going out to that home anymore. Police are not encountering that individual in the field anymore. And then another 42% is they know who the individual is. They know where the individual is, and they're still doing okay. So that's 90% 3 months after the police brought that situation to the hub that are still stable and remaining safe in their community. And that's what we want to see.
And because addiction in and of itself is not a rational thing. And so when they begin to try to, if you do not have a solution, a plan that can move them, it's the combination of mental health, behavioral health, conversations, how do you move them off of this? I'm actually very encouraged to hear what the police departments are doing. Is this all across the United States now?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, we have programs or partners that are in 42 states. We have more than 650 police and public safety partners. And just to what Charlotte was saying a minute ago, like you talk about statistics. I just saw this amazing statistic earlier today. Hope Not Handcuffs, which is a great program out of Michigan and New York. They have more than 190 police church locations where you can walk in and ask for help, or you can even call a hotline. You talk about peers, they engage peers, they engage people, clinicians and things like that in the area to get people referred to treatment. They just help their 10,000th person.
Wow.
And you think about this, and this only happens with those collaborations. And, you know, we see it across the country. And I know that, you know, there's programs in Florida that are doing great work. There's in Kentucky and Massachusetts, all of these places. And it's about learning from each other. That's one part of what we do as a network of these agencies, is to share that information. I wouldn't have been able to build my program if it wasn't for working with our Massachusetts partners. Something that I never thought that I would ever do from a small police department in Kentucky, that I'm working with chiefs of police in Boston and you know, all of these other areas in Plymouth and East Bridgewater, to create a program that I know is going to change it. So now when we work in Texas or Montana or Arizona, or, you know, we're learning from each other and building this, you know, plane in the air, really, because we're learning and we're trying to figure out what's working, what's not working, and constantly evolving.
You know, and I think what you two have really, really camped around, and we talked about the lived experience on that role, that plays a major role in this process. And one of the reasons I love, and the coalition, we're in our world, we're working on this with the child welfare world. We know folks that have had their children taken from. They had some really tough issues. Many of them have turned. And all of a sudden now, we want them to be able to go out and say, don't go down this path. Here's what you're going to see. And that lived experience. And so we're setting up the environment. Dr. Nellius and I believe in this concept. What you've said is that this is a community engagement project that utilizes law enforcement and government in that respect, but it's not government done. It's really driven by the collaborative of the community. You guys have been wonderful. I would love to sit here and talk with you all day. But if you have any closing comments that you'd like to make as we're closing out here.
I think I'd just like to say that what you just touched on is exactly what we're looking at. We used to always do our work in a silo. I worked at a mental health clinic. I didn't talk to Department of Children and Families. They didn't talk to the housing unit. They didn't talk to the police. But what is happening now is breaking down those silos and having that conversation so that all of those partners are working together to help individuals and family. And if we can help, you know, one family at a time adds up, that 10,000 people that have been helped by Hope Not Handcuffs, that didn't happen overnight. That's one person at a time. And that's what we need to be thinking, is breaking down those silos, talking with each other and helping people.
To echo those same concepts. I mean, every individual that you help, you could create generational change. And when we think about this, when we get started, and I remember the first person that walked in the door that I helped, and I think about the impact on that person and how she was able to get her child back. She was able to get a job. She went back to school. All of these things because we thought of a collaborative solution that involved police working, you know, arm in arm with public health, behavioral health, people with lived experience, and just figuring out a way to break down those silos. I feel like we're at that point now that there are solutions that are working and we can be better than we are now if we work together. And so I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful as well.
Well, I appreciate you too, and Pari, and the work that you're doing there. We really appreciate you coming in here at our conference.
Yes, it's been great. It's been a great experience.
And with that, we look forward to talking with you in the future.
Yeah, God bless. Thanks so much.